We're going to hold off on officially calling the Higher Education Committee to order until we have a quorum, and then we'll wait on the minutes for that. But first, I'll call Representative Omar to present her bill, House File 11575. 1575. And attention to everyone, Representative Jessup has brought treats for us. We'll be hearing his bill later, which I assume will go very smoothly because there are treats. So if anybody would like a treat, it's yogurt up on the rolling cart of the Pages half.
Representative Omar also brought treats, so I expect her bill to do very well as well.
Representative Omar has also brought treats, and we are also similarly excited to hear her bill.
You can tell that the treats don't do as much good up there as good as they do past downtowns.
Thank you, Chair. I did bring treats. There are some boosters.
Representative Omar has brought delicious sambusas, and we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the committee to order. Representative Omar, I'd like to move your bill.
Thank you. I move House File 1575 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Representative Omar.
Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. It's my first, so I'm excited for the opportunity. Members, this bill is a bill that you've already heard about. In general, it's been talked about a lot here in our committee. It provides funding for the Summer Enrichment Scholarship Program. In the bill, we have a point appropriation because we would like to keep the discussion open and see if we hit our target and possibly see how much we might be able to increase. Certainly, I would like as much as the governor is recommending for appropriation, but would also love to see if we can provide a greater amount. The agency is supportive and has been very resourceful in trying to make sure this program stays active and a lot of the young people that are benefiting from it continue to do so. We currently have 225 students on a waiting list, and in the first 8 days that the application was open for the summer enrichment program this year, we've already received over 100 applicants, so you can see the greater need for this. And right now I have a testifier with me and would like to hand it over to her.
If you could please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Walters, and I'm program manager with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Thank you, Ms. Walters.
So, Chair and committee members, the Summer Academic Enrichment Program supports academic achievement of low-income students. And I just want to give you some additional information about the program. The program supports low-income students because academic achievement is the key indicator of post-secondary success. Low-income students are designated Summer Academic Enrichment Program recipients because this student group has a low high school graduation rate and is identified as being at risk for not enrolling or completing post-secondary education. Over the last 6 years, the Summer Academic Enrichment Program has served from 430 to 848 students each year by providing a stipend of up to $1,000 to cover the cost of attendance at Office of Higher Education approved academic programs. The program was started in 2011 as a part of a federal grant obtained by the Office of Higher Education. That federal program ended, and since 2016, the program has been supported by $100,000 annually in direct state appropriation and unobligated financial aid funds. You have before you a two-page handout that summarizes the program's provision of service for 701 students in 2016. While 701 students were served, 252 remained on the waiting list because funds were not available to support them. In 2017, students attended 18 sites throughout the state that provided 51 academically based programs. And again, you'll see a summary of that in the two-page sheet. And you also have a January 3rd report to the committee from the Office of Higher Education that provided more details on this program. But to give you insight on the importance of this program through the perspective of students, parents, and a provider, I want to tell you about Maluba Seely, a senior from Brooklyn Central High School, Brooklyn Center High School, who accessed the Summer Academic Enrichment Program funding for summer programs at Carleton and St. Cloud State University. Mr. Seely has now been accepted at Carleton in preparation for his career in neuroscience. In addition, he has been offered a summer internship at a startup in the Silicon Valley for this summer. Mr. Seely has indicated that with his father working as a cab driver and his mother working as a home health aide, his family would not have been able to cover the cost of summer programs that have prepared him for his post-secondary work and his career choice. Now, the parents' perspective on this program is provided in a letter that we received from Jacqueline Thomas, a parent of a student who attended the St. Cloud State Math, Science, Computer, and Technology Summer Program on 5 different occasions. Ms. Thomas indicated that if the scholarship opportunity had not been available for my child to take advantage of, she would not have been able to attend a camp that she loved, as well as a camp that prepared her with so much substance for her to carry, not only through school, but through life as well. Ms. Thomas indicated that she had been laid off on 2 of the 5 summers that her daughter attended the camp. And through utilizing the Summer Academic Enrichment Program, she was able to secure a spot for her daughter. Based on her daughter's discovery of an academic area that she loves, her daughter is currently an IT intern at 3M through Genesis Works, and she will be attending Grambling State University this fall with a major in computer science and computer engineering. The perspectives of program providers is shown in the 2 letters that you received as handouts, letters from St. Cloud State and from Carleton. All of the programs attended by program recipients provide an opportunity for students to improve academic skills, gain exposure to the college environment, and often to career information. With concentrated time on core subject areas, students counter the summer learning loss that accounts for about 2/3 of the academic achievement gap between less advantaged students and their more advanced peers. The outcomes of this program have been highlighted in the works of the 2 students and in the letters that are referenced that are part of your handouts. But evidence of program success can be found in the academic work of the students who have participated over the last 6 years. And that's over 3,000 students over the last 6 years. So thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Walters. We have a few questions from members. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Walters, you said that there has been a waiting list, and perhaps you both know the answer. How do you prioritize the students on the waiting list for acceptance?
The applications are received, and it's first come, first served. So last year we served 701 students. They got their applications in early. And by early, like February and March, you know, we had a waiting list April May, the end of the school year. So it is first come, first serve.
Are there any further questions from members? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. So do these students, if they go to St. Cloud or St. Olaf or another site, are they living at that site for the duration of the program?
Chair, Representative Schultz, it depends on the program. Some of the programs are day programs, and some of them are overnight. So it depends. Some of them are overnight. The students that I referenced were secondary students, and they did attend overnight programs at both Carleton and St. Cloud. But other programs may be day programs.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how do you become a project site? Is there a competitive process, application process?
Chair, Representative Schultz, yes. We have programs submit applications to us, and then we do, as a committee of Office of Higher Education employees, we look at their academic portfolio, how focused are they on core content areas, and we accept them as program. We have accepted them as program participants. But with a stall, let's say, in funding, we haven't advertised for any new programs.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Any other questions from members? Okay. Representative Omar, do you have any further testifiers?
Thank you. Thank you again for the opportunity to present this bill. Thank you to all of you in this committee who are co-signers and co-sponsors of this bill. This program that for a relatively small amount can make a dramatic impact. And for students, for our state, and I hope I can count on your support. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Representative Omar. Is there anyone from the audience or the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Omar. Next bill up is House File 868. Representative Jessup, you move to the testifiers table and move your bill. Just as an announcement to members, we plan to finish our work today on the first five bills, with the exception of House File 1222, Chairman Nornes's bill, and we will recess after this committee to the call of the chair, and we will reconvene likely between 6 and 7, and we will meet in G3 of the Capitol. Representative Jessup.
Chair Christensen. Thank you. I move House File 868 for consideration by the committee.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Representative Jessup moves House File 868 to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Jessup.
Thank you. This House file before you is really designed for improving workforce development in Greater Minnesota, and this effort was established back in 2013. As a Greater Minnesota Internship Tax Credit. It had two goals in mind. One is really to essentially link up employers out in Greater Minnesota with internships to essentially test drive new employees in their operations. And then the other was really to expose Minnesota students to opportunities, employment opportunities in Greater Minnesota. Now the framework for this this project is already in place. A participating business can claim a tax credit equal to 40% of the salary of an eligible intern, up to a maximum of $2,000. And then the student receives some valuable real-world training with the employers that partner with the universities. Well, it's been a few years since 2013, and unfortunately, we're not seeing the participation in this program that we would like. We only have about 14 employers that have participated, and whereas the opportunity for tax credits is significantly higher, we're only seeing a few participants. From the business community, there's been a couple of issues with the current statute, and that's what we would like to look at here. And that is looking at the elimination of some of the language that's in this House file. And as you can see there, line 1.17, we would like to remove this. Would not have been hired without the tax credit described in subdivision 4. And then very at the end, 2.14 and 2.15, another deletion that we would like to include. Both of these are inhibitors for businesses to go ahead and enter into this internship partnership with employees or and or students that are at these universities. And just recently, very recently, on the 21st, the Minnesota Department of Revenue came out with their assessment and actually deleting both of these or these content in the House file is in their recommendation as well. They think that this will have a benefit for us as they move forward, as employers move forward. So what I'd like to do is have Dan Dornman, he's the Executive Director of Greater Minnesota Partnership, to speak on behalf of this bill.
Mr. Dornman, if you could state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Dornman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. We represent about 90 different organizations in Greater Minnesota, chambers of commerce, higher ed institutions, nonprofits, and businesses, all looking at ways to improve the economic vitality in Greater Minnesota. And we supported this bill in 2013, had a few concerns about the language as it went through the process, that it may not be used as we had hoped it would. And turns out that our concerns were valid. And with these changes, we think that it will be a very successful program. I should note that these changes were all in the tax bill last year that was ultimately vetoed. So had that bill been brought back in special session or something else have happened to it, we wouldn't be here today. So we're hoping that today you'll be kind enough to send us on to the tax committee, and they'll be kind enough to include these changes again in the tax bill like they did last year. With that, Mr. Chair, if anyone has any questions, I'd sure be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions from members? Seeing no questions, is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify? Seeing none, Representative Jessup, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair. Well, I would just appreciate your consideration of this, and we would appreciate your vote a yes to move this forward.
Okay. Representative Jessup renews his motion for House File 868 to be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. House File 868 is on its way to taxes. Next up, we will have House File 1206, which is a Representative Albright bill, which we heard in a previous hearing and laid over for possible inclusion. The Committee on Government Operations would like to hear the bill. And if there are no objections, we will move right to a vote to move it to the Committee on Government Operations. Seeing no one, Representative Albright moves House. Representative Zerwas moves House File 1206 to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and House File 1206 is on its way to Government Operations. Next up, we have House File 1430 from Representative Zerwas. You'd approach the testifier's table and move your bill.
Mr. Chair, members,
I'll
move House File 1430 be held over for possible inclusion.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 1430 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1430 is a bill to improve the state grant program by increasing grants for the more than 80,000 students who currently get state grants, and by making 10,000 more families and students eligible. Let me give you some background about the state grant program, and then Paul Cervenic, of course. Paul Cervenic from the Minnesota Private College Council will talk about how the bill changes the formula to help students. The state grant program provides Minnesota college students with need-based financial aid. Appropriations for the 2015-2016 biennium are $363 million, constituting a small share of the state's total higher ed budget, just 11%. It's the only part of the higher education budget that goes directly to the students. The state grant program benefits more than 80,000 students each year, 1 out of 4 Minnesota in-state undergraduates. Under my bill, 80,000 students would see an increase in their grants, and another 10,000 would become eligible for grants. It provides an important incentive to keep Minnesota's young people within our state by funding state residence college. It helps students enroll both part-time and full-time at all kinds of colleges, public and private, two-year or four-year. It targets lower and middle-income families, with 65% of recipient families making less than $40,000 a year. Most of these students would also be eligible for federal Pell Grants. It provides support for middle-income families, with 28% of recipient families making between $40,000 and $80,000 a year. In total, 93% of state grant recipients have family income that are below $80,000. In Minnesota, 50% of families with school-aged children earn less than $80,000 a year, and in greater Minnesota, the share of families earning less than 80% of the year climbs to 53%. Members, I could go on and extol the virtues of the state grant program. However, along with Mr. Tariq, we also have two students that can talk about the program in more personal ways than I can. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. Cervenek, are you first?
Yes.
Mr. Cervenek, if you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cervenek. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to begin by thanking Representative Zerwas and the other co-authors of the bill for their support for new investments in the Minnesota State Grant Program, and I want to recognize that not only members on the bill, but many members in this committee and throughout the legislature have been longtime supporters of need-based financial aid, for which we are all very grateful. The state grant program is based on a shared responsibility model, a model that calls for the student and the family each to first invest in the student's education and then provides financial aid for those students for whom their own investment and their family's contribution, along with the federal Pell Grant, is not enough to cover the cost of going to college. This bill makes improvements to the state grant program in two ways. First, it increases the amount of a student's grant by reducing the student share in the state grant formula. Reducing the student share is a direct way to reduce the need for excessive student borrowing, because a student really has only two options to pay for their share of college: by working and borrowing. And most students, especially lower income students, are already working in college, some working 2 or 3 jobs. Thus, covering increased college costs for them usually means more borrowing. An increase in grants by reducing the student share can mitigate or prevent additional borrowing. It's also a way to help students graduate on time, because it will help some students who feel forced to work perhaps too many hours to the detriment of their education. For students who are working too much, an increased state grant can mean they might reduce their work hours and increase their studying time and help ensure that they stay on track to graduation on time and get the most out of their educational opportunity. It could also allow an increase in the number of credits they take if they are part-time students, which would help them graduate sooner. Second, this bill increases the amount of a student grant by reducing the family share in the state grant formula. Families, of course, pay the family share from current family income and also from college savings, if they have any, although studies show a very small percentage of college costs is paid for from family savings. And parents also borrow to pay for college. For the purposes of federal and state financial aid, the family share is determined by the results of a federal determination when a student fills out its FAFSA. For many families, the expected family contribution is unrealistic, and it causes students or parents to borrow to cover some or much of the family share, or in some cases, the family share gets left to the student to pay for if the family can't. Because the federal determination is not realistic for many families, in the Minnesota State Grant Program, there's a mechanism already in place for reducing the federal expected family contribution when a state grant amount is determined. This bill uses that mechanism in the statute to increase state grants by reducing the family's Minnesota expected contribution, called the assigned family responsibility, in Minnesota by 10 percentage points for each type of student, a dependent student, an independent student with children, and an independent student without children. Together, these changes will increase average state grants by about 24% at Minnesota two-year and four-year Minnesota state institutions, and by about 13% at the University of Minnesota and at private nonprofit institutions. These two changes together would not only increase state grants, but as Representative Zerwa said, would also make about 10,000 more low and middle income families and their students eligible to receive state grants. We're grateful for the bipartisan support the legislature has always given the state grant program, and we hope this committee will make the state grant program a priority for investment in this legislative session. We have two students here who want to testify in support of the bill and tell you their stories, and I think I'll ask Myrna to start and then Brandon.
Thank you, Mr. Cervenek. If the students could state their name for the record and then proceed with their testimony.
My name is Myrna Serrano Barahona, and first off, I'd like to say thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to speak with you all today. I'm a junior at St. Catherine University, and I'll be graduating in 2018 with a Bachelor of Arts in Legal Studies and a double minor in Communication Studies and Nonprofit Strategies and Operations. My major is unique because it has allowed me the opportunity to attend both Hamline University and St. Catherine University, so I feel that I have a connection to both campuses. Just to share a little bit about me, I grew up in St. Paul and went to Highland Park High School, and while I was there, I did not see the potential of myself to thrive at a collegiate level. And this is for a variety of reasons, but mentors and programs such as College Possible helped me find St. Kate's. Financially, I was worried. Luckily, St. Kate's made it possible for my family to send me to college. I was so happy and still grateful because although both of my parents never went to college, they still encouraged me to go, and I sit here today proudly saying out loud that I am the first in my family to attend college. Owning my identity as a Latina and a first-generation college student, the community of St. Catherine University welcomed me with open arms and empowered me to be the leader that I am today. I have been incredibly involved on campus. Currently, I sit on the board of an organization called First Generation Scholars League, which is an organization that I helped found with other students my first year of college. The organization's mission is to raise social awareness, build community, and improve academic success with confidence and pride of first-generation students. I have done work with a variety of organizations and offices, including campus ministry, where I created a program with the Justice Minister surrounding political engagement for the past presidential election through a social Catholic teaching lens. Aside from this, paying for college hasn't been easy. My parents have always been able to provide love and as much financial support as they can, but a big chunk of the time I've spent in college, I felt I've been on my own. Not only did I need to learn how to manage my academic schedule, I also had to wade through the complexities of financial aid and at some point find a job or three, which I did work at some point too, just to pay for tuition. I have had work-study jobs through career services and still have many loans, but financial aid has helped me fill in the gaps that my parents and I could not. And it's definitely the reason I can graduate next year on time. The Minnesota State Grant gives me the choice to go to a smaller school with smaller classes. I am blessed to be able to afford a great school that I love. I have had campus jobs, taken out student loans, and worried some semesters with my parents about how we're going to pay, which is why my state grant award every year is so important. I value my education so much, and I will say that again. I value my education. I share this on student panels with prospective college students all the time. I am thankful that Minnesota invests in students through the grant program. Students like myself and Brandon Williams hope you will increase investments in the state program. So thank you, Representative Christensen, and the members of this committee for your time today, and I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Sorona Barahona. If you could spell your name for our notes, that minutes, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so I could pronounce it correctly.
Right now. Oh. First name, Myrna, M-I-R-N-A. First, second last name, Serrano, S-E-R-R-A-N-O, and second last name, Barahona, B-A-R-A-H-O-N-A.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to speak in front of you today. First, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Brandon Williams, and I'm a sophomore at Augsburg College. I'm a political science major, pre-law, with minors in strategic communications and economics. At Augsburg, I serve on the Senate and am one of two representatives for the Minnesota Association of Private College Students. I am very passionate about my community, my school, and education in general. A little bit of my backstory. I was born in Chicago, but my mom moved me and my siblings to Minneapolis in search of better opportunities for work, education, and safety for my family. Growing up in the projects and bad neighborhoods in Chicago, there was a lack of resources and opportunities. When I was younger, I was told that there is no door that you should not knock at, and if there was not a door to knock at, that you should build your own. I am the oldest of seven children in my family, so I have to lead the way. I got involved in my community growing up in Minneapolis and also went through the charter school programs such as Harvest Prep and Crystal Ray. It was when I was attending Crystal Ray that I heard of a scholarship, and the scholarship provided 21 full rides to three different colleges, now four. It was Augsburg, Bethel, and University of Northwestern. I'm happy to say that I was a recipient of a scholarship in which I won a full ride to college. So, wrapped up in my financial aid package was a bunch of federal aid, was a bunch of federal and state aid, included in the Minnesota state grant money. Really, every piece of help I could get between the scholarship and what my mom and I could afford to pay helped me stay at Augsburg. Now I am almost halfway done with my 4 years at Augsburg, and I am happy to say that I am still afloat. Yes, I have student loans, and yes, I have a lot of more schooling, if I hope to be a Supreme Court Justice one day. But thank you. But every grant and scholarship helps reduce my lifelong student debt total. I hope you all will increase investments in a state grant for Minnesota's future. Thank you, Representative Christensen, and the committee for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. And the Supreme Court vacancy, hope springs eternal. Representative Zerwas, if anybody from the audience wishes to testify, please come down now. Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, closing comments.
Mr. Chair, members, I told you the students would do a lot better job than I did. And so, thank you very much.
They did, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Myrna and Brandon for coming in and sharing their stories. I would be remiss if I didn't point out the fact that Myrna also claims, staking claim in the state of Piper, which is clearly the best of the MIAC schools. So thank you for that. And clearly, as we look at where we can invest money in higher education to have the closest and most immediate impact on students, it's in the state grant program. And so I encourage the committee to look at this bill and to consider an increase in the state grant program. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion to have House Bill 1430 laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion to have House File 1430 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and if you'll stay right where you are, we'll move to your next bill, House File 1652, if you'd like to move it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll move House File 1652 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 1652 be laid over for possible inclusion. I represent Zerwas to your bill.
House File 1652 is the developmental education bill. The hopes of the bill is to remove excess barriers from developmental education that students are able to complete their courses and go on throughout the program to complete their degree. We've heard from students and with some Minsky folks of some challenges in the current developmental education system. Students are taking courses that they may not need at a large cost back to that student. These courses take away from financial aid and do not count for credit. Many students get dismayed and turned off from college by having to attend these courses, and I think a lot of the frustration comes from the runaround as they look at one Minsky campus and are told these are the development ed courses that they need, and they look at a different campus and they're told that they don't need those courses or they need perhaps additional ones. And so I think that leaves people feeling frustrated, I think kind of at wit's end and wondering if navigating the college system is really right for them. Developmental education courses extend the total amount of time it takes to complete a program, causing students to take out more loans and keeping them in the classroom and out of the workforce longer. Some students truly need developmental education, but some do not. We have students who can testify to this, students who simply have had different challenges in their time in school, and other students that, again, have been told at one campus that here's the list of developmental courses that they need, and then literally drive a half hour or 45 minutes or an hour away to a different Minsky campus, still within the Minsky system, and are told the completely different set of developmental courses that they need. And so that frustrates the process, and not having that continuity, I think, is really an issue and a problem. So allowing for multiple measures when determining if a student requires developmental education is key. We need to review past courses, grades, try to find a way to connect with teachers and counselors, and to find relevant certificates or areas of study. We need to create advanced courses that students may complete developmental education courses at a faster rate, allowing them to join classes sooner rather than later. And then we need to establish a single score number of pass or fail across the acute placer system, not multiple numbers across the state, which vary by individual. We're testing for competency and proficiency, and if someone can meet the basic requirements, it should be that basic requirement at all of the Minsky campuses. You shouldn't get a score that is good enough for one technical school but not another technical school, or one Minsky program but not another Minsky program. That creates a lot of confusion and frustration, not just among students and counselors, but among staff and families as well. Instituting an incentive program for those who pay out of pocket for these courses to recoup some of their out-of-pocket costs when completing their degree or diploma will also help students meet these basic requirements to allow them to continue on to their course of study in as quick and affordable fashion as possible. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I do have a few testifiers, including some students that have some personal testimony on how the current system has been a challenge for them to navigate.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. McDonald, if you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Representative Christensen and committee members. Thank you for allowing us to testify for you today. My name is Angelique McDonald. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota State College Student Association, which represents roughly 180,000 students from the two-year colleges and universities across the state of Minnesota. Today we are here to support legislation on developmental education reform. DevEd can be one of the biggest barriers to completion for thousands of students, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. This committee has already heard testimony regarding how many workforce numbers Minnesota will need over the next 3 to 7 years and how many of those positions will need to be filled by two-year college graduates in order to meet the workforce demand. At this time, being frank, it's highly unlikely that we will meet that demand. There are two central reasons aside from cost as to why students are falling short in completing their programs: inadequate preparation and difficulty navigating college. High school graduates from high poverty areas are typically first generation students and are not prepared for college coursework. Similarly, working adults who are either going back to school or entering school for the first time find that the lapse in their education results are putting them into developmental education courses. As many of you know, these courses do not count for credit, and they do take up financial aid, which of course has life limits. Nationwide, 70% of students who get assigned to developmental education courses never complete college. The second reason students aren't completing college is due to their difficulty transitioning to college after working and at times supporting a family. Two-year colleges and universities often lack the funding to offer more than a single advisor or additional support staff to help students chart their degree work, fill out financial aid, and determine which correct courses they need to take to continue and pursue their degrees. House File 1652 seeks to reform some of the barriers that are causing students from completing their programs across Minnesota. This bill will create a single active placer pass or fail score instead of multiple pass or fail scores across the state. In addition to streamlining the test score of the active placer, this bill will allow for multiple measures to be implemented when assessing whether a student truly needs a developmental education course. Instead of one test being the definitive answer, advisors and professors will be able to communicate with one another to review students' past grades, speak to current or past teachers, and so on, to give faculty a bigger picture of the student's academic abilities instead of just a snapshot. This bill also allows for incentives for some students who are placed in developmental education and seeks to develop accelerated options so that students can get through the process faster and that they may begin coursework without having to wait for multiple semesters to start. These are just a few steps to begin to address making developmental education less of a burden on students. MSDSA is very grateful for the support of MnState, and we are happy to have Ron Anderson here to testify in support of this bill. This is certainly a collaborative effort between students and MnState to help create a system that is better at promoting the college completion rate. Thank you for your time and support, and I would like to call up two of our students at this time.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. If students could state their name for the record and then proceed with their testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Cecilia Damian, and I attend Inverhoes Community College. I'm a member of my student senate, and I'm a member of Minnesota State College Student Association. I'm here today to share my personal experience with developmental education. I'm a strong student, however, I've never been a good test taker. I had A's in math in high school, but when I took the AccuPlacer, I scored really well. They put me in a remedial math course. I had to take that before I could continue my college level courses. And I had to pay hundreds of dollars for that specific course, as well as the materials out of my pocket for it. By the end, I received an A for the course, and the teacher remarked that I could have taught the class myself. I am in support of multiple measures of developmental education. I feel that if advisors had reviewed my previous grade, they would have seen that I didn't need that math class. Or, at the very least, they would have discussed about it and perhaps could have spoken with my high school teachers. I also support a single number for placement scores from the AccuPlacer. I found out later that my math score would have been taken at other community colleges within the metro area. Then, I think if everyone is taking the same test, then the pass or fail designation should be the same across the board. To have multiple scores for different colleges seems very inefficient. Thank you for taking your time to listen to me today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Damian. And if you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time to listen to us today as we testify in support of House File 1652. My name is Minda Nelson. I am the president of the Minnesota State. I'm the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, and I am here today to testify on behalf of the two-year community and technical colleges across the state, many of whom were unable to be here, and that is the stories that I will be telling you. I would like to thank Representative Zerwas for highlighting the challenges that so many of our students face with developmental education, as it is in high need for reform. The first student with a story is Mana. She's from Rochester Community and Technical College, and she was originally born in Canada, but she now lives here in Minnesota. She works and attends school in Rochester. She graduated from high school as well in Rochester. When she entered college, she was placed in ESL, or English for as a second language, even though the only language she has ever spoken in her life is English. She had to pay for two semesters plus books for out of pocket for developmental education she did not need. This meant that she could also not begin her regular classes until those two semesters were completed. The only test she took prior to attending RCTC was the AccuPlacer. She was not given a test specifically to assess her English proficiency. This caused her a lot of stress financially and delayed her studies by one full year. The second account comes from Amanda, a student at South Central College in Faribault. Amanda came to college 6 years after graduating from high school, after she had started her family. She took the AccuPlacer, and her results showed that she needed to attend a reading class and two math courses before she could begin taking the necessary classes for college. Because she couldn't afford to pay for them out of pocket, she used her Pell Grant to pay for them. She didn't understand or realize until just this winter that she would not have enough financial aid to finish her degree. This semester, she's struggling to pay for her family and bills. There are multiple days in a week where she doesn't eat to make sure that her children can both eat and every bill gets covered. She's very close to completing her degree, but she feels it is impossible to continue at this rate. By taking the developmental education courses and not understanding how it was going to affect her financially later, Amanda is stuck considering whether or not to take time off to save up for enough money to complete her degree. The courses also set her back from graduation by a full three semesters. She feels that as none of the developmental education counts as credits towards a student's degree, it hurts their ability to complete their education, as it not only delays their graduation, but can sufficiently increase student debt. The final story that I would like to share with you today is of Tavian. Tavian was born and raised in Vietnam and began speaking English at the age of three. He moved to America when he was 16 and graduated high school from Creighton Durham Hall. When he began college, he was placed in ESL classes, even though he had a diploma from Minnesota high school and never took an ESL class in high school. Tavian enjoyed his professors, but the courses were, in his case, pointless. He had to take the classes for almost two full years at the out-of-pocket cost of $5,000. These stories are just a few of the many students who are facing unnecessary courses, debt, and program setbacks because we don't offer multiple measures when evaluating if a student truly needs to be in developmental education. We need to be creative and offer more opportunities for those who do need to take developmental education so that they don't wind up multiple semesters behind in their courses. We also need to revisit how we determine who needs these courses, as it would appear that the sole use of the AccuPlacer is causing more harm than help. Thank you for your time here today. I hope that you will support reform for developmental education and vote yes.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson and Ms. Damian. If anyone from the audience wishes to testify, if they could come down now. Mr. Hughes.
My introduction short because I am here most of the time. My name is Mark Hughes. I'm testifying today in favor of Bill number 1652. Craig Zerwas, members of the committee, thanks for this time. This is like a holiday to me today because back in the late 70s and early 80s when I went to college, I faced the same dilemma. I was born with a developmental disability. I have cerebral palsy, but I don't let that stop. when I got to, I spent 2 years high school at Highland Park and graduated out. Then the Volk Rehab Counselor, which we went through in St. Paul, they really didn't know what to do with me, so they sent me on to college down at Southwest State University in Marshall, Minnesota, which was really the one and only geared for, they thought, people with developmental disabilities. I got down there and I had trouble catching on learning because there were no supportive academia like there would be with this bill. And I had I took electives because I knew I was starting to have trouble, so I took a music elective. I can't sing today like I could back then. But anyways, I took a music elective and the professor made fun of my handwriting, which was a disability, and flashed in front of the 35 students and asked what language was written in. The chancellor down at the college happened to be my neighbor, so I went dark to him and said, I got half my credits in for my degree. I'm going to try to get on at Business Day School or Carlson School, as it is today. So I went and applied at Carlson School, and by the skin of my teeth, for a flight word, I got on. And I did graduate, but they then had the supportive program. My point in my testimony today is that nobody should really be turned away as far as education. If you're going to go on in the workaday world today, you really do need some kind of a secondary education. And I think that I would support this House File 1652 because I think if you can't learn out of a textbook and learn better hands-on and need the extra supportive materials for academia, then it should be brought forth. And I'll agree that I think it's going to be more of an expense to the state, but in the long run, we'll be saving money because we'll have more people in the workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Anybody else from the... Thank you, sir. If you could both state your names for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, those are our chairs. We sit in those.
Musical chairs.
Yeah. Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ron Anderson, and I serve as the Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs with the Minnesota State System. I'm joined today by Shirley Johnson, a colleague and faculty member who teaches at North Hennepin Community College. We are here to testify in support of the bill, as we believe that Minnesota State, through this bill, will be moved forward in its efforts to improve and reform developmental education, and that this bill moves us in the right direction. It allows Minnesota State students, faculty, staff, and administrators to work together to engage in critical, thoughtful, and strategic development of a plan that would re-envision developmental education on our campuses. Last week, Ms. Yang shared with you that Minnesota State has already begun crafting a draft strategic roadmap that seeks to advance our developmental education efforts across all of our colleges and universities. Ms. Johnson and I serve as the co-chairs of the statewide Developmental Education Committee within Minnesota State, the group that was responsible for drafting that roadmap. I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Anderson, Ms. Johnson.
All right. For the record, my name is Shirley Johnson, and I'm a developmental faculty member at North Hennepin Community College. Sorry. What I would say, I'm going to go a little bit off script and just say that this strategic roadmap that we are looking at is a recognition by the field of study, developmental education, that we need to change. And I think that this bill really does recognize that, and for that reason we support it. So let me talk a little bit about the roadmap. The strategic roadmap was developed through collective engagement with students, faculty, and staff, and administrators on a system-wide developmental education committee. So this was a cross-functional committee. We are currently in the process of vetting our plan Our plan is to have campuses review and refine this roadmap this spring. House File 1652, therefore, aligns with our current efforts and would emphasize the importance and encourage us to emphasize the importance of the use of multiple measures, uniform cut scores, system policy changes, accelerated pathways, alternative cost structures for developmental education, and statewide and national best practices as part of the plan. In addition, our draft roadmap thus far also includes strategic goals in the areas of aligning assessments with K through 12, collaborating with our secondary partners to increase college and career readiness, strengthening our advising and student support, and increasing professional development for faculty and staff.
Once the strategic roadmap,
Mr. Anderson,
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Once the strategic roadmap is finalized, the plan will advance Minnesota State's vision for developmental education, guiding our priorities and establishing timelines and deliverables, and ensuring that we hold ourselves accountable for this work. The bill provides campuses with the flexibility to meet the diverse needs of our students. We look forward to working with the Minnesota Legislature to share our approaches and the programs that our colleges and universities have implemented thus far, and also to share the work that we will continue to advance. And we want to reiterate that Minnesota State has a steadfast commitment to student success and serving those students who need developmental education as part of that pathway to success. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson and Ms. Johnson. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify? Questions from members or Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably you two could, Mr. Anderson and Ms. Johnson, you could probably answer these questions, and so I understand the bill fully. First of all, what is a cut score?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a cut score is the score on the ACCUPLACER test that is defined as the minimum entry score for enrollment in a college-level course. We do, as a matter of policy and practice, have a common cut score across the system so that score is uniform for entry into college level. Where the scores may differ are when you get down deeper into the developmental curriculum.
And Mr. Chair, is that a proprietary test that's given? So would a cut score be a proprietary term?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a proprietary test, but the cut scores are defined and developed locally, so they've been validated with our curriculum and our students.
Thank you. And another question.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talk about alternative cost structures, could you kind of fill in what that means?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. That's looking at currently our cost structures are the same for developmental credits as they are for regular college-level credits. Our discussions are surrounded how might we think about that differently in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if the testifiers or maybe the author could. I've heard and just... for my benefit, I'm not clear in terms of what the difference is between an ACCUPLACER exam and the ACT.
So you want me to go ahead? Well, the ACCUPLACER exam is an exam that is given after the student has filed for admission, and it is a placement test that is just designed to determine whether or not they are ready for college-level work. Under our current structure, the ACT is an alternative to the ACCUPLACER. So should a student come in and they have an ACCUPLACER score, I believe, of ACT score of 20 or higher, is that?
It varies by discipline.
It varies by discipline, but basically that would give the student an alternative way of not bypassing the ACCUPLACER. So an ACT score is a substitute for the ACCUPLACER score.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
And so, to the testifier, I've never heard of the ACCUPLACER, and I have three children who have gone through college. And we've all I mean, it's paramount of import that when you have a senior in high school that all they think about is the ACT. And so I'm curious with regard to the ACCUPLACER. You speak of the ACT as if it's the secondary motivation as opposed to the ACCUPLACER. And in my mind, as a parent, the ACT is primary and the ACCUPLACER is one that I've never heard of. And so I'm trying to figure out, for the benefit of the members on the committee and maybe the people in the audience, what is the emphasis placed on one or the other, and why are we unaware of the ACCUPLACER as much as we are aware of the ACT exam?
Mr. Anderson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. The ACT test, just to refine a point that Ms. Johnson was making, was initially designed as a college entrance test used in admissions decisions. So for our state universities, the ACT is a common metric that is used in that admissions selection process, for lack of better terms, as well as many privates and proprietary schools across the country. In our two-year colleges with open-door admissions, we do not screen at the college level for a minimum ACT as part of an admissions requirement. The ACCUPLACER test itself was designed as a placement instrument, which is fundamentally different than an admissions tool. We have been working over the last decade or so to understand the relationship between the two instruments, so that we have established for the ACT cut scores that essentially exempt a student from needing to take the assessment, the placement test, because they've demonstrated they are college level based on the ACT scores. But the ACCUPLACER is a test that was designed to integrate with college level and developmental curriculum and to differentiate at lower levels of skill a student's preparation, for lack of better terms, in order to place them into pre-collegiate coursework, as well as identifying those students who are college ready. So that's the difference in the origins of the test and the way that we use them. It may sound like ACT is secondary because for us it's an exemption from taking a placement test that places you if you meet a certain threshold.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, so when you talk about, and I heard in your earlier testimony, you talk about with the ACCUPLACER that are specific cut scores that are relevant to various disciplines. And when you talk about those, are those consistent across the universities or the vocational technical institutes, or are they variable based upon the locality or the institution themselves?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those tests, cut scores that place students in the college level are consistent by Minnesota State Board of Trustees policy. Where you will see variability is in placement into developmental curriculum, and as a student enters, depending on which program they are enrolling in, they may have a different threshold for being ready to enter their program. So I may not need to take college algebra for my particular program, so my mathematics placement does not need to be at a college level in order to begin my program coursework. That's where we have differentiation.
Mr. Chair, just one final question with regard to a high school transcript. If a high school graduate would identify with a very high proficiency in a specific area such as mathematics or biology, what due consideration is given to those proficiencies as they would enter into the consideration for college coursework, and whether or not that justifies taking some of these remedial semesters, because we are talking about the public good being served in the high school, whereas when you're going to vocational or two-year institution, you're actually obligating someone to pay sometimes thousands of dollars for something that in hindsight was not necessary. And so you can appreciate the concern that's been raised by the testifiers, and I'm just wondering how you intend to respond to that going forward, because we are looking for an expansion of the workforce, not an inhibition by those people seeking work by virtue of losing out on a track in a career path that is of their own making.
So,
Ms. Johnson,
what I would say is that that would be a component of multiple measure that we would be looking at. Clearly, most of the multiple measures research suggest that it is a combination of GPA with other factors that we would be looking at. So GPA would be a component of the multiple measure that we would be considering within the multiple measures plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Anderson and Ms. Johnson. As long as there is no one else from the audience that wishes to testify, seeing none, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 1652 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. It's the intention now to recess to the call of the chair. We will meet again in G3 of the Capitol, likely between 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock, but check your email. Stay tuned to your email for updates. The committee is now in recess.
Okay. One of those days.
Well, I've got this. All I have to do is sit there for 30 seconds and get the door.
Well, job growth, it might be, if you're talking about job growth,
yeah, and I'm not going to, I'm not able to.
Back well, Buffalo.
Okay,
job.
Let's see.
Before we recessed?
Yes.
Do we need minutes from recess until the next?
No, these are from, so because Buzz is chairing, when the meeting, he's the one that needs to run the minutes.
Oh.
So that's why Drew couldn't do it.
Okay.
At least that's my understanding.
Okay.
So, I think I forgot to give you these. These are...
amendments?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody should have the bill. But if not, I have extra packets ready to go in case.
They do. I double check.
Double check. Okay.
These are the extras. Everyone showed. I think I got one in everybody's.
Okay, just in case I'll hold on to one.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it comes to you. You just need a gavel and everything else is ready to go.
Wow, this is big.
I know. I was hoping for a higher attendance, but
7 p.m. on a whatever day it is doesn't.
I think it's Tuesday. I hear somewhere it's Wednesday.
Oh, gosh.
Wednesday somewhere.
With AJ just happening.
Wow. That's a lot. They brought the bacon on.
Oh, God.
I'm feeling good forever.
Yeah.
This is not my chair.
Well, they're good. So you get the same place.
Well, there was another committee. Someone raised to be in here in between. How are we? Does someone have this room? Commerce? I heard it in their room. Commerce just had that. I don't know. But walked in on our huddle.
Oh, I know.
This is a bad policy. Because that's where
we were in
our huddles.
And they wouldn't come.
They had something else to do on Tuesday night.
The crowd. But no, they weren't coming out.
Yeah.
The kid had a good go.
You might actually have to have this.
Yeah, add it for
me. It's cool.
I'm going to. Let's do it. I don't know. I think you made one.
You actually?
I think a lot of them are.
I don't think you do if you're at the time.
Oh, look it, now Harrison shows up. Nice to see you. I mean, it's a really big crowd. It's all the teams are here. So.
I just got a text from Tyler. She's changing
He
takes 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Unless
you're
at politics.
Karen, I can get one to tell jokes.
That's our group.
Yeah. And I'm going to call my friends.
Well, the clock is ticking, so it's Chelsea was saying that we had a Kelly Knight situation where we need to make a joke. I was like, how do you get in here? Like, how does your makeup get in here?
My mom
got it.
When she comes to visit, she won't.
I don't get it. I love Darden.
Yes. Yes.
We can have a meeting.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, we're ready to go. Ready? Got one time. I once I got it close to the date. I went in last Tuesday and they go, oh, hi, Lord.
It's a good thing we had all those snacks today.
What time? Hi, Lord. What do you want to do today?
Mine was left over from this morning. There's enough left.
I did my best to finish it.
What are you having? What are you
having? I actually did, So tonight was just a period. I had one door this tonight.
Yeah. No, I don't think that can
be true.
Chelsea won't eat it.
I've heard from some
Chelsea won't eat it.
But we've been kind of because you were told. This year,
I really had thought.
We were only needing to bring treats to first building. You don't bring had treats in the new committee. I don't know about you in your peers, but
it's rough for you guys.
I don't know. I'm hoping you're not getting similar treatment from your peers. But it's been a little bit brutal. I haven't experienced it. But then they say, stick a tool in but it was kind of like one of the additional learnings that I
needed. Oh, good, Charlie. Yeah. I don't think
we're
no longer introducing.
Oh, man. I don't know, there's a lot of committees.
Once you get in front of the one.
I'd like to say that.
No,
Ben.
No, I
can't. Yeah. Matt Bliss. But yeah, he was out cooking lunch. And he was just merciless. He had already provided treats.
Can we
hear
the mic off?
Yeah.
Well, that's a next good thing for you.
Yeah.
or policy members. Oh,
they have moved. Can we have 10 minutes?
Oh, well then.
And they have three members of activities.
And healthcare?
Yeah, HHS and environment, they're both meeting too.
Okay, well.
They're right there. They're here for you. No, I think they're all right. Can I have them? Yep, the next one.
I don't even know. I'm serious. Age is so much.
Oh, yeah.
So we convene the Higher Education and Career Readiness Policy and Finance Committee. Apologize for everybody having to wait. Some of you maybe missed your, or maybe did you? You all had dinner, probably. I'm the only one that didn't. But we do want to recognize the presenters here tonight, make sure that they get home sometime tonight. And so I'd like to, at this time, invite, see, what do we got? I should probably look at my agenda. Okay, I'll move House File 1222 to be held over for consideration. So at this time, I'd like you to begin testimony on my bill. From the Office of Higher Education, I should add. Okay. Did we do the minutes? Okay, all right, proceed. Welcome.
Hello, committee members and Chair Nornes.
Is that mic on?
Am I talking loud enough? I mean, there's a lot of space, so it's probably... my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I think you have an amendment to the bill.
Okay, we do. Okay. The A-17 amendment should have one at your place.
What is
it doing?
Yeah. Chair Nornes, committee members, this amendment is just to repeal some rules for a program that was removed in like 2004. So it's just some cleanup.
All right. Any questions? Otherwise, all those in favor of the... The quorum doesn't carry over from this morning. Oh. We don't have a quorum.
Oh.
So, maybe we can do that amendment at a later time?
Okay. No problem.
Okay. Now, proceed.
So I'll go through the bill kind of high level, and most of the changes in the bill are related to our licensing and registration department. And if there's questions, Betsy Talbot, our manager of licensing and registration, is here to answer any of those. So the section one of the bill are technical changes for federal conformity of forcible sex offenses in the campus sexual assault reporting statute. In 2015, the law was passed for our office to facilitate campus sexual assault reporting, and during that process, the feds removed the definition that is referenced in the law, so we're just clarifying to keep the intent of the law. Section 2 eliminates an inadvertent loophole for colleges offering only short programs ineligible for participation in federal financial aid programs. This section also puts in place broad language regarding administrative and financial capability in the eligible institution statute, which will then be further defined in the agency termination rules. Section 3 is a technical change to the large animal vet loan forgiveness program. We contract this program out to the Department of Health, and their current practice is to allow for confirmation, and currently the law has students have to get a notarized affidavit, and that's just a hurdle for the students that participate in the program. And sections 4 through 35 pertain to the licensing registration, and I'll go into more detail of those provisions a little later. Section 36, MNSCU 2-year occupational scholarship pilot program. It's a technical change to accommodate students in programs that are not designed to allow students to complete the required 30 program credits in the first academic year. Now, we'll go into, I don't know if there's any questions on those provisions specifically. Okay.
Any questions? You're doing well.
Okay. Yeah. So for the provisions related to licensing and registration, Betsy is the new manager of that department, and with fresh eyes, she looked through some of the statutes, and with given some of the things that happened in the past several months with some of the institutions, the provisions and changes being made in this policy bill are meant to be proactive in providing clarity and guidance to institutions on what is already in current practice, and in some cases also provide some options for institutions. These items are not meant to be controversial. In fact, the office has spoken with the institutions about these provisions, and while there is a bit of uneasiness on some of the items, we're hoping people are getting more comfortable as we discuss them. So sections 4 through 8, 11, and 16 are all modernizing and updating language. Updating language for the types of documents required based on general accounting language and to be consistent with U.S. Department of Education. An example is Section 16, which changes the office to back to the Office of Higher Education, because we also deal with out-of-state institutions and students that may not know what the office is. Section 10 clarifies the difference between program accreditation and institutional accreditation. Section 9 and Section 18 are providing institutions lower cost options to meet surety requirements and record retention requirements. Section 12 and also Section 31 is about advertisement, and we know that there might be some discussion on that, so we'll come back to that. Section 13 is giving the office the ability to grant degree-granting schools time for, one, closing institutions to teach out currently enrolled students, two, for programs, for new programs, a 5-year window to receive accreditation, and three, securing alternate accreditation if their accreditor is deauthorized by the U.S. Department of Education. Section 14 amends 136A.653. It amends the exemptions to close an inadvertent loophole for mass open online courses or MOOCs, and creates a no-cost, transparent process for schools to apply for exemptions for regulation. Section 15 modernizes the religious exemptions for degree-granting schools by creating a no-cost, transparent process for schools to apply for exemptions for regulation. Section 17 is concerning student complaints. It adds the office's authority to investigate and resolve student complaints at degree-granting schools, including creating a statute of limitations and requiring schools to take remedial action beyond fining a school or closing a school. Now, I forgot to mention that so there's the degree-granting and non-degree-granting statutes. And so some of this language is duplicative for the non-degree granting, so I won't re-explain them all over again. So when we get into Section 19, that's all the non-degree granting institutions. So Sections 19 through 26, 31 through 33, and 34 through 35 are duplicative of the things I just explained. The difference here are Section 27, which is for private career schools licensed by another state agency or board. It amends the application requirements for non-degree granting schools licensed by other state agencies but are participating in state financial aid programs and requires those institutions use the same tuition refund policy as other schools participating in state financial aid programs. Sections 28 through 30 is a modernization. It's giving students the option to use email for cancellations of contracts and also an option to use email for giving notice of withdrawals. This also aligns with what the feds allow. Sections 31 is the same as Section 12, which I mentioned earlier, which deals with the advertisements, and I'll let Betsy Talbot explain that a little more.
Thank you. So Section 12 is meant to clarify different advertising standards for institutions. The current language provides little guidance to schools, other than that schools cannot use advertisements that are not truthful, deceptive, inaccurate, fraudulent, or misleading impressions about schools, programs, or services. The new language that we're proposing is meant to add items that the office has historically identified as problematic. The language is not intended to change our office's current practices, but increases the transparency and make it easier for schools to comply with these issues. The language also provides our office with the authority to require a retraction of misleading or fraudulent advertising. One of the goals of the agency is to provide better tools for our office to deal with issues with institutions. Right now, we have the option to fine an institution if they don't remediate their action, or if they have problematic behavior, we can revoke them. We would like to have a better solution for institutions that are acting outside the scope of their authority. We want to be able to include, like, tuition refunds. If there's a problem with a student in particular or a student population, we want to be able to help those students in a meaningful and robust way without impacting the other programs that could be not problematic for an institution. As Minnesota has seen in the last year, it's really disruptive when schools close. And the hope is that this language can address some of those issues that schools have had in the past and provide more robust consistency in advertising claims and provide additional tools to fix those issues moving forward. Again, we would hope to avoid closing institutions.
The policy bill. We're open for questions.
Thank you. Are there any member questions? Okay, I could start out. Representative Jessup.
Just one real curious. We have Section 12 and we've got Section 31. They look identical. Mm-hmm. Why so?
We have...
Ms. Talbot.
Sorry, Chairman, Representative Jessup. We actually have two statutes for the type of institutions we regulate. We have one for the degree-granting institutions, and then we have another statute for the non-degree-granting institutions. So we want to make sure that we have the same language in both protection. So our bill is definitely very duplicative because of that issue.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Thank you, Ms. Talbot. I have a question about, why are these requirements being targeted? Why are they only being required of private institutions?
Chair.
Ms. Nikki. Ms. Oliver. My apologies.
So that's how the legislature written the statutes. We only have authority over the private institutions and not Minn State or the University of Minnesota.
Is there any concern at the Office of Higher Education that this, obviously higher education is a really competitive environment between all the different schools and as far as cost and education being provided, and is there concern that this would put our private institutions in Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage with some of our public institutions? Ms. Talbot.
Good question. Right now, I have the general sense that our proprietary schools, in particular, are at a competitive disadvantage because of the PR environment that they're under. The amount of scrutiny and negative spotlight that they have received historically in the last couple of years has no doubt an impact on their enrollment. My hope with these changes would not have any further impact on their ability to operate and would not significantly increase any burden that would not make them competitive. I think we want to increase the trust in our institutions in the state of Minnesota. We want students to feel confident that they can enroll there and that they're confident of the claims that they're receiving during the admissions process.
You know, I've heard you talk about kind of, and this is aimed at kind of a small number of fraudulent operators, all of which are for-profit schools, right? Ms. Calvin.
Chair, yes. The media has been really focusing on the for-profit sector, yes.
So if this is really all about the for-profit sector, why does this also apply to the non-profit private schools? Why isn't this just narrowly aimed at the bad actors, all of which are in the for-profit sector?
Chair, well, our changes aren't specifically narrowed at the for-profits. It's to cover all the institutions under the statutes that we have authority over.
Which is consistent with the statutory framework. The way it's designed right now, Chairman, is that it doesn't make a distinction between the for-profits and non-profits. It just has all the privates being subject to the same requirements. And normally with our non-profits, they don't have a lot of these types of practices in their admissions practices with, like, placement statistics, and they don't normally calculate those the same way because their accreditors don't require it. So they won't have many of these types of issues and claims.
So would this is obviously, you know, do you know if the Office of Higher Education would be willing to consider kind of narrowing the statute language or the language in this bill to narrow it down to the proprietary schools, the for-profit schools? Would the commissioner be interested in that? Does he think that would be something that's doable?
I can't speak on what the commissioner. I can bring your question back to him, and we can discuss it further. But we are open to making changes to this to be more friendly. But I can't answer your question directly. I will talk to the commissioner about it.
Thank you. I appreciate an answer from the commissioner. I appreciate that. Other member questions? Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Chair. Have we got any opinions or responses back from some of the private institutions to these recommended changes?
What was that, Representative Jessup? I apologize.
If we have gotten any responses from any private institutions to these recommended changes, have we gotten any responses?
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Is there anyone in the audience that would be interested in giving a response to this bill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Amy McDonough. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Private College Council. And I just would say briefly that we are looking at the bill, and we do have some concerns along the lines that you raised, that unfortunately we're one of the only states that treats nonprofit colleges and for-profit colleges the same, and we're under the same statute. So anytime there's a change or a prohibition that affects private colleges, you know, we're looking closely at it, and I guess we would ask to continue to be able to work on the language because we're concerned about the unknowns, and some of the vagueness of the wording of the bill concerns us.
Thank you, Ms. McDonough. Thank you, Representative Jessup. You know, I just have a couple of, really just one more question, I think, for the testifiers. We'll take one more. Sorry, I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Jessup. My name is Katie Mishrakanis, and I am the Chair of the Minnesota Career College Association. And I would definitely want to share the vantage point on House File 1222. As an association, we have always worked closely with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and appreciate that we were privy to the bill's language as it was being developed. We are a very regulated industry delivering post-secondary education, and while we appreciate the need for rigorous and appropriate regulation, we are concerned about some of the broad and confusing language this bill offers, such as the term higher-level entity used in line 3.25, and then later in the bill, depending on how this term is used, it may be confusing to, as to which parent company or holding company it is, especially in a complex and more multi-tiered structure. We also would request that some parts of the bill define things more clearly. For example, how is personal funds in line 6.5 defined? Lastly, we are concerned about the advertising requirements as a whole. We think the broad scope and subjective requirements, such as how is evidence-based, could use some work so that schools can comply. We have provided feedback both to the Office of Higher Ed as well as your staff, and we'll be happy to move, if the bill moves forward, to create clarity and understanding of this. I would caution singling out the rest of the for-profit sectors. I think that through further discussion, we could look at ways to address concerns that there might be without separating. So, any questions?
Doesn't look like there's any member questions. Thank you, Ms. McKinnis. Ms. Talbot or Ms. Oliver, or whichever one would be better to answer this question, why is the Office of Higher Education seeking to be at the HLC meetings when they, you know, when they go and visit each campus?
Chairman, for two primary reasons. One is for educational purposes for our office. We have new staff, and we really don't want to be duplicative with the HLC. And we want to better understand their processes. And there's no better way to learn that is to be on ground and to hear and experience those site visits. We, you know, speaking from a new manager, when I took over the role, the first accreditation site visit that I attended was actually with the DAC, and it was for a small licensed school. And not knowing and seeing that would have been a great disadvantage to understand the accreditation process and what our institutions experience when they meet with their accreditors. And we do, it is our purpose to go there at least and see each accreditation site visit for each accreditor. It may not be every institution, but it is really to help us and help the institutions better match our processes. Two, we also have an expectation to support our institutions. We have been invited to an accreditation site visit for one of our schools in March, and it is with the HLC, and it is to express our support for a new program and that our commitment to this institution and this program. Three, I don't think we ever used it in something that's antagonistic or to do oversight of an institution or to regulate in a different way, but it also provides us an opportunity that's very structured to see and visit our institutions versus an unannounced audit of an institution or, like a site visit that's separate. We just use it as an opportunity to, that's already structured by the accreditor, to visit the institution, visit their faculty and their staff, and to get to know them a little better and kind of share those resources.
Thank you. So why, just trying to understand, some parts of this bill, why is the extra language on advertising needed? I know they're, I'm reading because I want to make sure I read the statute right, but there's already language in statute that says OHE can revoke registration or approval from a school that presents information about the school which is false, fraudulent, misleading, deceptive, or inaccurate in a material respective, in a material respect to students or prospective students. So why is the language on page 8, line 21, dealing with advertising requirements needed? Ms. Talbot.
Chairman, I think, again, the goal of this language is not to actually increase the burdens of our institutions, but it is to provide clarification. There are things that we've already identified that are misleading, that are tend to give inaccurate information to institutions. And the best way to provide notice to schools so that they can meet those requirements is to put them into statute and that they have that force with our institutions so they have an understanding of how they're supposed to operate. No matter what, like if we look at the language as proposed as being vague or broad, there's nothing more broad than a statement of saying an institution cannot make inaccurate, misleading, or fraudulent statements, because there is so much latitude of what that means, and we want to identify just easy and simple things that we can give our schools notice that are problematic. Like, it's really meant to be a transparency tool for our institutions and give them better expectations of how to operate.
So, leading into that, who makes the decision whether something is evidence-based and can be validated and is based on the current conditions? And is this a single person? Is this a body? And what are kind of the controls that OHE would have to make sure this is enforced consistently?
Thank you, Chairman. Right now, we have a team of people who evaluate the advertising claims, and it's normally a dialogue with the institution. Like, I have one right now where I had a staff person who had a problem with a video that was on about transferability of credits. So she posed a question back to the institution as saying, we think that this advertising is problematic. If we do, you know, confirm that it is problematic and we both agree, then that video will have to be removed from the website. But it's normally a starting point to establish that. If we decided it is problematic and we decided it is a violation of that law, and I can tell you in this case for this video, it was not. We were able to talk it through and it was fine. I ultimately have been delegated the authority to determine whether something is problematic and whether I'm going to fine or revoke an institution. That is subject to a Chapter 14 hearing process if we do take action against an institution. So that's essentially the oversight process the office currently has.
So if I'm hearing correctly, Ms. Talbot, you have, there's a team that talks it through, but at the end of the day, you're the one who makes the decision. The buck stops with you?
That's correct.
Okay. I appreciate that. So talking about the student complaint process in Section 1217, this only applies to private schools, right? And I know you talked about that's the only ones you have the ability to regulate. But would the Office of Higher Education be interested in broadening it to help students from public institutions as well?
Chairman, it's a limited authority for the public institutions if they participate in the National Reciprocity Agreement and the student complaint is related to the Reciprocity Agreement, so a distance education student outside of the state. And we would have to apply these student complaint procedures and kind of craft them specifically to the guidelines of SARA. I'm all for helping students. If an MSU, or I'm sorry, Minnesota State, or a U of M student calls me and I don't have authority over their complaint now, I try to help them in any way I can. I try to give them the resources, either phone numbers or emails or the policy that covers them, so that they are not given a runaround or misdirected to a different entity, because we always want to be here to help the student regardless of the entity that they attend. Even if it's an out-of-state institution, and we've gotten complaints from students at the Citadel who are from Minnesota, we will try to help those students.
Thank you. Other member questions? Other member questions? Anybody else from the audience who would wish to testify? Seeing none? Representative Jessup moves that House File 1222 be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher ed omnibus bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lean.
Thank you. How are we going to take care of this amendment? I understand we have it. Has that been moved or?
Representative Lean, I think we can take care of that and vote on it tomorrow in committee. We also need to approve the minutes from our last committee hearing. We don't have a quorum right now, so we can take care of both of those things when our meeting starts tomorrow.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we are adjourned.